And now it is my privilege to introduce my friend Nick from Visalia.
Good evening. My name is Nick. I'm an alcoholic. There we go. I'll just work with that. All right. Nick, alcoholic, how are you guys doing tonight? I'd like to thank the Valley Group for having me tonight. This is a year ago or more, I never would have thought that I would have been standing up here and giving this experience strength and hope from my life. I'm very grateful today to be part of Alcoholics Anonymous and to be able to share my story, hoping that something that you hear tonight might help you in your recovery. My sobriety date is June 10th, 2017, so I have just in a couple days I'll have 8 months of sobriety. It's not my first attempt at AA, and it's been a long road, but I'm glad that I'm here. When I was young, I grew up in Europe, and my parents were in the Air Force, and oh, I got it. There we go. Parents were in the Air Force, and at a young age, my mom decided to leave and left me with just my dad. And as I grew up, I had to deal with that. And when I turned six, my dad had remarried, and she adopted me. So when I was a young kid in elementary school, I was pretty much one of the only kid in my group of friends that didn't have a mom. You know, like I had a mom that was at home, but I knew because my parents and my grandparents decided to tell me that I was adopted. And my dad was a great guy, and he did a great job as a single father until he remarried. But I think at an early age, it really took its toll on me, you know, wondering why I wasn't loved or if I did something wrong, you know, all the normal stuff that you hear about when you don't have a parent at home. All of my friends, you know, either had both parents at home or like most, a lot of us don't have dads at home, you know, and not, you don't hear very often about not having a mom at home. And I'm sorry, I'm really nervous. As I grew up, I always felt like I was an outsider. I was picked on when I was young, and I didn't like it. I don't think anybody does. And from an early age, I didn't want to be who I was. I felt like I was different from the crowd. Not sure if that was really the case or if it was just something that was, you know, inside of me from my mom leaving. And at an early age, towards the fourth, fifth, sixth grade, I started wanting to be somebody else. As I got into middle school, I was tired of the friends that I had, and I was tired of being picked on, and I was tired of being bullied or whatever. And so I joined a boxing gym, and I started boxing. And then I changed my friends in middle school. Once, you know, middle school's come, and there's all of a sudden there's a whole new group of kids, and so I started hanging out with the cool kids. And you know, I left all my other friends behind, and that was really where I think it started for me, trying to be somebody else. As we got into high school, of course, running with the crowd that I ran with, everybody was doing drugs, everybody was smoking weed, drinking at parties every weekend, some of us like every day after school, and I started getting into trouble real early. My grades I never was able to pick up my grades from where they were before I, you know, started drinking. And so I remember the first time my first time drinking, we were up at a lake up here, at Camp Sequoia, or Lake Sequoia, and it was like where Camp Chulacoya is, and it was a YMCA camp, and it was called Family Camp. And we were... There was an older guy. His name was Mike, and he brought up a 20 or 12 pack or a 30 pack or whatever of Budweiser, and we went up on the side of this mountain. And I remember, It wasn't the first time that I had tried alcohol, but it was the first time that I'd had a full beer by myself, you know. And I think I probably had like four or five in that first sitting. And I remember at least for a couple hours feeling really good, you know, feeling different than I had ever felt before. And right away, I mean, I knew that I wanted to feel that feeling all the time. My personality is such that once I find something that I really like, I just dive head first in it, and have a very addictive personality. As high school kept going, my best friend Chris and I, we would get this guy that lived across the street from me, and he was kind of a bad influence. His name was Ryan, and he anonymity, huh? And every night I would go over and give him $9, and the $9 would get us a pint of Jägermeister. And so he would go, and he lived across the street, and I had an old hot rod car in the back then, and for some reason the driver door wouldn't lock. So I'd just give him the money, like leave it on his doorstep, and then in the morning when I got up, inside my center console in my car was the pint of Jägermeister. So my friend Chris and I, we would jump in the car and we would go over to Wittendale Park over there and just pound that Jägermeister before school. And I remember, I mean, it was, you know, 2 or 3 days a week we would do that. I was working at the Holiday Inn. It was my first job. I did a catering setup, so I was setting up the business meetings and the weddings, and we were doing a lot of drinking out there. So I had a job. I had money to pay for it. And we would get to about second or third period, and my third period class was geometry. And by geometry, man, I couldn't see straight. I couldn't think straight. And fourth period, I had auto shop. And the auto shop teacher was, you know, I was kind of like a, I don't know, like the teacher's pet in auto shop because I was always around cars. And he would let us take off, or we would ditch. You know, I got into a lot of trouble. I got my parents, my dad was in law enforcement, which I didn't mention. But so he was gone a lot. But he was, when I was in high school, he was a captain of the SWAT team. So he was gone all the time. And I never saw him. But my mom would always tell him, and every night, you know, every morning when I'd see him before I go to school, you know, I was always getting lectured. I was an only child, so he was, you know, I'm not sure he really knew what to do or if I was getting disciplined the way I should have. But I definitely was on the wrong path, and I guess they say cops' kids and preachers' kids are the worst. And so I never really liked to smoke weed. I really loved to drink. We drank all the time. I used to have parties. We'd have keg parties at my house when my parents would go to Vegas or something. And my senior year, I remember being at a party, and the group of guys that I was hanging out with all said, "Hey, you know, we've got this. I got some coke," and you know, and I remember thinking to myself, "This, you know, this has got to be the worst thing in the whole world to do," you know, and I, you know, from my neighborhood, that wasn't something that people were doing, and from the moment I did it, I was hooked, you know, and it was an endless supply of drugs and alcohol after that. My senior year, right before graduation, I was on track to graduate, and the day before graduation, I took my civics final, and that was one of the required 5 units that you needed to get out of high school, and I bombed my class because the night before I'd been out in the country with a bunch of guys at a keg party, and I stayed up all night and didn't get any sleep. And you know, you would think that right off the bat, after that I didn't get to graduate, I had to go to, I ended up moving to Fresno, so I went to Clovis Adult School to get my diploma, and that was pretty embarrassing. But, you know, it was just like, okay, well, you know, once it was over, and I just kept, you know, continued to mask who I was, continued to drink, continued to use drugs, and continued living that lifestyle. Luckily, I did get to graduate high school before my grandfather died, and it was just a couple weeks, you know, before he had his heart attack. And so that, you know, that was something that was important to me because they looked up to me, I had looked up to my grandparents, and they believed in me so much because when my mom left my dad in Europe, they brought me back home for a year to Fresno. And so I was kind of like the youngest child, even though I was the grandchild. You know, my dad was the youngest of four boys, and then he had me so young, it was almost like she had another kid. And so my grandma always thought of me as one of her sons. And all of my other cousins hate me for that, but they always call me the golden child, and which doesn't help anything. But that's one part of my story too, is, you know, because of that relationship that I had with my grandmother, she was my number one enabler. She was the person that if dad said no, mom said no, and I had nothing else, nowhere else to go, you know, grandma had a lot of money. Grandma couldn't say no to me. And I took full advantage of that. And unfortunately, she's not with us today. And she died on December 12th of 2011. But those are amends that I've made off to the side, you know, to her, because she wasn't able to get to see me sober. And I'm very sorry for that, because she was like the mother that I'd never had when I was a young kid. And but, you know, those are the turns that life gives you, you know, and there's, you know. hold on, give me a second here. When I got out of high school and I finished my diploma, for some reason I thought it would be a great idea to become a bartender. And for some of you guys that are as old as me or older, there was a bar downtown here called Shag Nasty's, and then it turned into Charlie Mac's, and Charlie Mac's turned into Bogart and Lulu's. And I started my bartending career at Charlie Mac's, and when Adam bought out Charlie McIntyre, I went over to Bogart and Lulu's, and I was one of the first three bartenders there and worked there for a while. And in that time, I got engaged to my high school sweetheart. And, you know, every night after the bar, I'd work Wednesday through Saturday night, and, you know, was making like $200 in tips every single night. And after that, you know, I was the bartender for my Coke dealer. We would have beer and alcohol on tap for after we got off work, and we would go over to one of the other bartenders' house every single night. And I wouldn't get to bed till 7-8 o'clock in the morning. Well, at this time we were starting the rehearsals for the wedding, and, you know, I don't know how she even stayed this long, but it was a Friday night, and I'd been out all night, and I went home, and it was about 6 o'clock in the morning, after doing a bunch of coke and drinking all night. The next morning we had to meet with the preacher for the church, so that was part of the prerequisite to be able to get married inside of this certain church here in town. And, well, let's just say I didn't make it. And I called her about a half hour before I was supposed to pick her up or she was supposed to pick me up. And I told her, hey, we got to reschedule this. I'm not feeling good. And she, you know, she'd been around the block with me for 4 or 5 years. So she knew what was up. And about an hour later, I was asleep. My dad comes in and says, hey, you know, Valerie's at the front door. And so I go up to the front door, and you know, she handed me the ring back. And she said, I don't want to ever see you again. And, you know, I just stood there. And, you know, you would think that would be the wake-up call. Well, you know, I probably went out partying that night, you know, and our relationship didn't last too much longer. It was off and on for a few years. I ended up moving up to Fresno, hoping to rekindle that thing, and it didn't work out. And so when it didn't work out and she asked me to leave after living together for a month, I went home to Grandma. So it was just me and Grandma, and my dad hated me, my uncles hated me, and I had a normal job for a while, you know, after I was trying to get my stuff together, and I was working for a housing firm here in town where we did closets and base and, you know, put up doors and stuff in brand new houses. And I got to the point where I couldn't afford the commute anymore from Clovis all the way back down here to Farmersville every day. So I went back to bartending, and that turned out to be one of the worst things that I ever did. I started working at Applebee's in Clovis, and it was, you know, you never fall far from the routine, you know. As soon as I got to know everybody and fell into that crowd again, it was 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning. You know, Grandma wasn't going to tell me anything, you know, and I'd go out all the way up to Table Mountain, like every single night, and blow all the money I made sitting there drinking and playing cards all night. Come home with no money. Having the next morning, hey, Grandma, can I have, some money for gas? You know, I had this super sport Camaro that, got like 8 miles to the gallon. And that was, I thought I was cool. I thought I was all that. And I had nothing to my name. I had nothing to show for myself, but, failures and bad memories and, leaving a wake of destruction in my path. And we're talking, this is probably like 2003, 2004. And I all of a sudden was introduced to crystal meth, from one of the cooks at Applebee's. And, man, what a disaster that turns out to be, and I'm sure many of you in here have tried it and know what I'm talking about. It wasn't long before I lost everything. The car was repoed. I didn't have a way to drive around. The girlfriend that I had at that time, she left me. We got, you know how that stuff messes with your brain, and you get in a fight, and then the cops are called, and all of a sudden I'm in jail for a domestic violence. And I didn't hit her or anything, but she was so scared that she called the police, and when they showed up, in Fresno, if the cops are called, somebody goes to jail. And there was and I was angry, and I was spun out. I was on like a 3 or 4 day bender, and I deserved to be in jail. And I went to jail, and while I was in there, she had let the cops know that I was counterfeiting money on the side, which didn't work out. It wasn't any good, and I'm no genius because it was horrible. But luckily, because it was so bad that the Secret Service didn't get involved, and they left it with a, because the Secret Service has jurisdiction over anybody that tries to counterfeit money. So once they interviewed me and learned how fucking dumb I was, they just gave me a felony check charge, and so my dad once again swooped in and he never got me out of shit, but he just said, you've got to do something. And so when I went to court, I told him, because I didn't believe I was a drug addict or an alcoholic, but I went to court and begged, and they let me out on OR that day. I probably spent 3 months in jail, but when I finally got my court date, after continuance, they released me to my dad for a day, and then I had to check into Westcare, which is a recovery home up in Fresno. And I'm a two-time loser at Westcare, so there's more to come. But I went up there, and it was like the worst 30 days of my life. But it dried me out. I got the detox that I needed. After I went to after that 30 days, I went to my probation officer, and I was really scared. I wanted to go out and use. I wanted to drink, and I asked to go to Turning Point, which is right in the heart of downtown Fresno, right next to the casinos. Right, down, if there's a Skid Row in Fresno, it's right there. And so I stayed 90 days transitional living, I thought I had it. The famous words, I've got this, I went to work, I got some good jobs, and I stayed clean for 4.5 years. After I got out of transitional living, I did start drinking again, but it kind of progressed, and that takes me to I was working for a company. I was a supervisor up in Fresno for a big manufacturing warehouse, and I met who would end up being my ex-wife, and we worked in the same company. She was in the front office, and I was out, as a supervisor. But she was as much of a addict and an alcoholic as I was. Didn't know it. Her best friend was like the Ashley Swearingen, her right hand lady. So we got to go to all these crazy like grand openings, and they were doing this revitalization of downtown Fresno. And so we're at this sports bar, and I had, like I said, I'd been clean for 4.5 years, but we were three sheets to the wind, and they look over at me and they said, hey, let's get some coke. And I was like, hell yeah, what the fuck. And in the back of my head, as I was driving from downtown Fresno all the way to like Fashion Fair to get this, to pick it up from some guy that worked for me, I didn't even know, in the back of my head, I thought, you know what, this is, you know how this is going to end. You've been down this road before, but that didn't stop you. So we did get married. We made a lot of bad choices. A lot of drinking. The drinking was super heavy. There was a lot of drug use. And I remember thinking she was worse than I was. And then I was like, how does she have the audacity to ask me to stop? You know, and I just remember having a resentment. You know, and we all have resentments in here. And there was, you know, long story short, the marriage only lasted 2 years, maybe a year and a half, and we separated. We went my own way. She went her own way. We didn't have kids. I owned my car. She owned her car. And the house that we were living in was owned by her parents. So I just packed my shit and left. basically, never really saw her again. You know, a couple times here and there just to sign documents, get stuff out of the way. But thankfully, you know, I got out of that situation. In the middle of that, right before we did separate, though, I had to tell on myself. I called my boss, and I had been up for about 3 days. And somehow, some way, this guy that worked for me got me to do some more crystal one time. And one time, after like 2 months, I was, you know, out in the wind. Nobody knew what was going on. My leadership position at the company had escalated, so I had more responsibility. And I had heard somebody say that if you have a problem, you can always go to your boss, and they have to give you that chance. And I don't know how I got the courage to make that phone call, but I did. And I remember sleeping for about 24 hours, and then they called me into the office, and they sent me back to Wesker. And so I go back to Wesker thinking, okay, well, it's dry out, and I get all this, you know, over with. And you know, I was having a lot of problems at home with her. And so if any of you guys know how that is, being in a relationship and basically being locked up, it's like, you know, the most stressful thing in the world. And as soon as I got out, within 6 hours, I was drinking. And basically, I think pretty much, I don't remember the details of it, but I started using it again as well. Finally, I left, and I came back to Visalia after we split, and I moved into my own little house, and I was drinking by myself. I was isolating. I had a group of friends that we would go out to Firkin and Hound on Wednesday nights, and I remember, you know, it was just, we make up dumb things like, we're going to take a shot of tequila for every time the Giants score a run or something. It was during baseball season, and I remember one night just, you know, it was being really bad, and I was on my way back to Fresno, going down Caldwell to go get loaded. And it was about 11 o'clock at night. I should never have been behind the wheel. And there was a police officer on the side of the road, way out in the middle between Shirk and 99, just sitting there in the dirt. And I flew past him, you know. And he pulled me over, and I couldn't even talk. And somehow, some way, he just gave me a ticket. And I thought, oh, shit, you know. And so it was kind of like the wake up call, but the wake up call only lasted a couple of days. You know, I didn't get myself to a meeting. You know, I failed to mention that in Fresno, I'd been on Prop 36, and had to go to some AA meetings. And I remember thinking, man, this is some weird shit going on. And I didn't like it. And I'm not going to lie. You know, they say this is the club that nobody wants to be a part of. But you know, like I said in the beginning, I'm happy to be part of this club today, because my life's completely changed. Basically, I lost that job up in Fresno, and that day I met one of the district sales managers. He was my age, and he happened to be in the area, and so we met up at one of the bars in Fresno, and I, you know, probably sat there and drank for 5 hours, and then drove home, changed my clothes, went down to the bar, and drank until they closed at midnight. And on the way home, I blacked out. I think as I was blacking out, I don't know if I was just being stupid or if my foot got pushed all the way down. I came to at about 120 miles an hour coming down campus, headed directly for COS. And I slammed on the brakes, and I skidded. My skid marks were there for 4 years. Skidded for 6 houses. No joke. 6 houses. Went across Woodland, and right there, it's right to the side of the new gymnasium that they built a decade ago. There's two metal standpipes, or concrete standpipes, that go up for wheelchair access. And my car went directly between both of them and Both mirrors got busted off the car. Went up in, hit a couple rocks, broke the wheels off, and you know, I lived one block over and two houses down, so right next to right across the street from where the parking lot is for the basketball gym there. I'd live right there on Pecan Court just before, what's that street? Noble. So I walked home, and I was in bed, and I probably, like 30 seconds. I remember hearing the sirens, and then, you know, about, I left the car there, doors open, hey, it's time to go to sleep. About 30 seconds later, you know, and, you know. But after they threatened, I don't know what they said through the door, I opened up and they said, "Did you know your car's over here?" I think so. So they gave me the sobriety test right there. I failed. And, you know, they were like, my dad was still in law enforcement at the time. And he was high up, and they said, "Well, we're going to call your dad." I said, "Fucking call him if you want. I don't care." You know, it was past that point of caring about anything. And my dad shows up, and it's about 3 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning. And somehow, some way, they just said, "Well, we're going to release you to your dad." Well, they left as soon as my dad got there, and they had already given me the ticket. I got the DUI. I got damaging city property. You know, leaving the scene of a crime. Blah 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 blah. Like the list went on and on and on. And so my dad says, "All right, get your ass in my car. We're going home," you know. And I'm like, "I am home." You know, "No, you've been released to me. You're going home with me." And I said, "Uh-uh." And I took off running and I ran over to COS. And I remember standing behind a tree and there was a little rock and I was like, and he was like, "Nicholas, get your ass over here." I was about 36, you guys. The next day, I went over to his house, right? He finally got pissed and left. But my car was impounded, and, you know, I had to go get some stuff out of it. And, you know, so I go over to his house, and we're sitting in the backyard, and he says, "Don't you think you should be going over to one of those AA meetings? Because, you know, you're an alcoholic." Like, this guy is smoking crack, too. I was like, "Dad, just because I get a DUI doesn't mean I'm an alcoholic." And you know, I just remember thinking to myself, that is the most ridiculous thing in the whole world. But, you know, it goes to show that we can, like, we hide from ourselves. Not only are we hiding from the people that we love and hurting the people that we love, but we don't even know who we are, you know? And it's so obvious for everyone else in our lives to see who we are and what we've become that, you know, it's pretty embarrassing. But, fast forward a couple of years. So from that instance, I got drug court and DUI court and all that. I got a second DUI after that. That's when the DUI court drug court started. I went through drug court. You know, it's an 18, back when I did it, it was an 18-month program, and I got through it in 18 months and 3 days. You know, I only had 3 extensions. I had to spend one night in jail for a missed test, but that was, you know, I don't know how I missed the test. So I really was sober. You know, I really was, I worked the program. I had a sponsor, and many of you know him, but, you know, I still was just doing what was asked of me by the courts, and I didn't take it seriously. But my life got better. I was sober for 2 years and 3 days. And after the 2 years, you know, the girlfriend that I had at the time, we talked and we made a plan, you know, and I always look at my sponsor when I say this, you know, "I got this." You know, and I thought I had it, you know, I had stopped the step work. I had stopped going to meetings a couple months before. And, you know, I thought I had a plan of how to, like, drink responsibly and how to only have a couple. I'm not going to ever drive. I'm going to use Uber, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it worked for 3 months. But after 3 months, there was just one night, like having two Coronas turned into having 18 Coronas. And after having 18 Coronas or 12 or however many there was, I went through my phone and found the one name that I knew would find me some coke, you know, and I did. I went out and got loaded, and I own a small business. It's nothing big, but you know, I had built it up. I was doing great. I was in a productive relationship. I had a lot of money. I had probably at least $10,000 in liquid cash, just like in the bank or in my sock drawer. And within the matter of about 6 months, I had ran the business into the ground. It wasn't closed, but it was, you know, my business partner was ready to leave. I had no friends. All the people that I had met through sobriety, made friends with my roommates that I had at the time. You know, all that was gone. The girlfriend that I had at the time, she, you know, I remember sitting in my bathtub one time after she had given me hell and said, after hanging up, I remember thinking to myself, because of all the past experiences over the last 15 or 20 years, if you don't get your shit together, you're going to lose that too, you know, and I remember sitting there and I was crying. I was, you know how it is in the morning. And at least until you go back and call your dealer again. And, you know, but in all honesty, I knew where it was going and it went there and I lost it, you know, and I lost everything. Luckily I was able to keep the car that I had. Everybody had given up on me. I had nowhere to turn. I had no money. I was spending, I was either buying, you know, I'd go and get the 3-pack of Modelos and drink those and like an 8-ball of cocaine every single day. I mean, I was spending like at least $300, depending on where I was going or, you know, how much I was doing. And that didn't last very long. And I remember thinking the only thing I can do is the one time in my life that my life was okay was when I was going to AA, when I was coming to meetings. You know, whether I was doing it right or wrong, at least my life gotten better. And I remembered that, and that seed had been planted for me. I came to about a dozen meetings, but, you know, quickly would go back out like a day or two later. Just wasn't ready. And this will sound funny, but the only thing I had left was I didn't even have a place to stay. The business that I have, it's a little paint and body shop, and so there's a little studio apartment in there, and so I was living in that in my business, which is ridiculous. But it was just me and my dog Daisy, and I remember I was having the worst week, and then it was on a Friday, and she ran out because my business is on a major road, and so she ran out in the street chasing a guy on a bike, and she was killed by one of my friends, and that was when I felt like it was like the most alone that I'd ever been, you know. It was after months of trying to get back in. I couldn't get back in, and when I did that, I remember I made it through the weekend somehow, and then the next week I was trying to get to a meeting, and I didn't know where to go, and I called my friend Elle. I don't know, maybe some of you know her, or I messaged her or something, she directed me to a meeting over at the Hillman House in Tulare, and I drove over there. And while I was sitting there, you know, I remember thinking, man, I was embarrassed because some of the people knew me, or at least had recognized me. And, you know, when you're trying to come out of it, you think everybody's looking at you and talking about you. And I did, and you know, but something felt right. And so the next day I went to another meeting, my girlfriend Monica, in that time we had just met, and this sounds funny, but I was really trying to get sober, and I was trying to put myself around people that I knew were sober, that had some time, and you know, and you know, she just celebrated 2 years last week, and so I'm very proud of her. But the you know, I was between Elle and Monica, you know, I was trying to get to meetings, and finally, you know, it kind of clicked for me. I had one more little mess up in between there, but just one single day, and then I went back to, I got to a meeting the next day. And since I got sober, it's, you know, you hear about the promises, you know, reading the big book, and those promises started coming true like the next day. I mean, everything, your mind starts to clear out. It's not fast, I'll tell you that. But you think it is, you know, and you feel like everything's starting to go right. And one foot in front of the other, I started reading the book. My friend Elle, I went to a meeting she had suggested, and at the end of the meeting they said, you know, like much like they did here tonight, if there's anybody that is able to sponsor, can you stand up or raise your hand or whatever it was. And I remember, the secretary for this meeting, Bill H. I was thinking in my head, I need to ask Bill to be my sponsor, you know. And for some reason, you know, he wasn't there that night. And Elle's boyfriend raised his hand, and I was like, you know. And I'd seen him around at the Alana Club before in my prior sobriety. And so at the end of the meeting, I asked him to be my sponsor, and he's been my sponsor ever since, and it's been a great relationship. You know, he, with all the years of sobriety that he had, he was able to pass on a lot of knowledge and help me out through some relationship problems and other things that we went through. But you know, they say when you start looking for a sponsor, you know, find somebody that has what you want. And even though I didn't know him, I knew that how he had helped Elle, you know, from talking with her. I think we, you know, we hit it off pretty much, and it's been a good relationship. Working the steps, I finally decided I never turned myself over to the, you know, turned my will over to God the first time around, and this time I was put on my knees. I was at such a bottom. There was some other issues going on, and everything all came to a head one night, and you know, the next day I just remember thinking, I'm fuck this, man, I'm done. And that's when I got down, and that's when I, in my opinion, I worked the first, second, and third step, but it seemed like in one night. I didn't, but you know, they're so closely, you know, once you decide and make that decision, looking back on it now, I mean, it just, you know, I see the similarities in all of those. I had done a four-step before, and I wasn't as scared to do a four-step this time since from a couple years ago when I was in drug court. So I didn't have that fear that a lot of people have, and it didn't break me down as much as it, you know. I knew what I was going to say. I'd already had it all planned out, but it was really, for me, the changing moment in my sobriety was my sixth and seventh step. The sixth and seventh step really made me, you know, turn around and take a look at inside myself. And you know, it was easy when I worked the fifth step with Ryan. You know, he was like, well, don't you see, that's why that all happened because of that thing, you know. And you know, it's like, oh shit, you know. And you really start to learn about yourself. And I was talking before the meeting with one of my friends here, and you know, I was explaining that to him, you know, it's the steps are laid out, and you know, I wanted to go out and tell everyone I was sorry. I wanted to make my amends. I wanted to go do my ninth step, you know, the first day I was sober. But you know, now that I've worked the steps for the first time, I can really see why the steps are laid out in order, and how important it is to work your steps in that order. Because like I said, in my experience, the sixth and seventh step was really the changing point. You know, I got to see the way I react to people, the way I talk to people, the way my relationships go, the way my family life goes, the reasons why my business was failing. Everything in my life started making sense, you know, and it was a lot easier for me to go hat in hand and hold myself accountable with the people that I needed to make amends for. And even though I've worked my steps, I still am making amends. You know, I have a lot of amends to make, and I do them when I can. And it's been a very productive experience so far. But the other thing that, not only with the sixth and seventh step, learning about myself and how I'm a truly different person now, I can see it. But a couple months ago, a guy asked me to be his sponsor, and I had to table it with some guys that I knew that had more time than me, my sponsor and a couple gentlemen here tonight from my home group. And most of them, all of them but one, said the same thing, you know, like, this is what the program's about, you know. If you feel like you can at least guide them in the right direction and be a temporary sponsor, then go for it, you know. And so I did, and that was kind of the, it was going to go with the advice of what my sponsor said, and he was along those same lines. So I did it, and unfortunately he couldn't be here tonight, but it's been one of the most rewarding, like, fulfilling type feelings of working with another alcoholic. And it's weird how God will put, or your higher power, however you want to say it, will put people in your life. And you know, our stories are very similar. My sponsee and I, we never met each other before, but you start to realize how your higher power is working inside your life. Now I have really bad, stressful days where I just, you know, I don't want to give up, but you know, it's like the days you just don't want to do anything, go home and like kick your feet up and just watch TV or something, or, you know, and it's always the night that I have to meet with my sponsee. I can't describe the feeling. Those of you that have sponsees know this feeling, but of sitting there for a couple hours and I remember the one night, I just, horrible night, I was having, business was going wrong and I had angry customers and I just didn't want to do anything. And when I left there, I felt like $1 million. I felt like I had, like, my whole day had been redeemed just by sitting on this couch and doing something, you know, man to man with this guy that, you know, I didn't know 6 months ago. And for me, that's what I, to today and continuing forward, that's what it's all about for me. I jumped into service. I'm on a couple committees for like Soberfest, also for the Tulare County Young People of Alcoholics Anonymous, Tukipa. and then I have a couple of commitments at different meetings. I'm a coffee person for one meeting and I'm a treasurer for another meeting. And you know, it holds me accountable. I'm the kind of guy that if I take a week off or a couple weeks off and I don't see anybody or I don't work the program in some sort of way, I'm not going to come back. That's what it takes for me. And today, finally, I have accepted my disease. I've accepted where I'm at. But I welcome it today because I sometimes think about the way I used to wake up, the lies that I would tell people, the squandering of either money or, you know, whatever. And I don't have to deal with that today. And today, that's enough to keep me sober and to remind me. It's a reminder. I haven't shut the door on my past because if I do shut the door, I'll forget that. And forgetting that would be catastrophic to my sobriety as well. I'm truly grateful to be here. I hope that something that I've said here tonight has resonated with you. And today I'm a truly grateful alcoholic. And my name's Nick, and I'm gonna keep coming back. Thank you.